Science and Ethics. Those who maintain the insufficiency of science appeal to the fact that science has nothing to say about value. As there is no consensus of opinion about ethics, it must be understood that what follows is my personal belief, not the dictum of science. The study of ethics traditionally consists of two parts, one concerned with moral rules, the other with what is good on its own account. Rules of conduct, many of which have a ritual origin, play a great part in the lives of all peoples. Rules, such as the prohibition of murder and theft, have an obvious social utility and survive the decay of the theological systems with which they were originally associated. But as people grow more reflective, there is a tendency to lay less stress on rules and more on states of mind. This comes from two sources, philosophy and mystical religion. What they value is a state of mind, out of which, as they hold, right conduct must ensue. Rules seem to them external and insufficiently adaptable to circumstances. One of the ways in which the need of appealing to external rules of conduct has been avoided has been the belief in conscience. It has been supposed that God reveals to each human heart what is right and what is wrong, so that, in order to avoid sin, we have only to listen to the inner voice. There are, however, two difficulties in the theory. First, that conscience says different things to different people. Secondly, that the study of the unconscious has given us an understanding of the mundane causes of conscientious feelings. The diversity in the deliverances of conscience is what is to be expected when its origin is understood. In early youth, certain classes of acts meet with approval and others with disapproval, and by the normal process of association, pleasure and discomfort gradually attach themselves to the acts and not merely to the approval and disapproval respectively produced by them. As time goes on, we may forget all about our early moral training, but we shall still feel uncomfortable about certain kinds of actions, while others will give us a glow of virtue. To introspection, these feelings are mysterious, since we no longer remember the circumstances which originally caused them, and therefore it is natural to attribute them to the voice of God in the heart. But in fact, conscience is a product of education, and can be trained to approve or disapprove, in the great majority of cases, as educators see fit. While, therefore, it is right to wish to liberate ethics from external moral rules, this can hardly be satisfactorily achieved by means of the notion of conscience. Questions as to values, that is to say, as to what is good or bad on its own account, independently of its effects, lie outside the domain of science, as the defenders of religion emphatically assert. I think that in this they are right, but I draw the further conclusion, which they do not draw, that questions as to values lie wholly outside the domain of knowledge. That is to say, when we assert that this or that has value, we are giving expression to our own emotions, not to a fact, which would still be true if our personal feelings were different. It is obvious, to begin with, that the whole idea of good and bad has some connection with desire. Anything that we all desire is good, and anything that we all dread is bad. If we all agreed in our desires, the matter could be left there. But unfortunately, our desires conflict. If I say, what I want is good, my neighbour will say, no, what I want is good. Ethics is an attempt, though not, I think, a successful one, to escape from this subjectivity. I shall naturally try to show, in my dispute with my neighbour, that my desires have some quality which makes them more worthy of respect than his. Ethics is an attempt to give universal and not merely personal importance to certain of our desires. Ethics contains no statements, whether true or false, but consists of desires of a certain general kind, namely such as are concerned with the desires of humankind in general. Science can discuss the causes of desires and the means for realizing them, but it cannot contain any genuinely ethical sentences because it is concerned with what is true or false. The theory I have been advocating is a form of the doctrine which is called the subjectivity of values. This doctrine consists in maintaining that if two people differ about values, there is not a disagreement as to any kind of truth, but a difference of taste. The consequences of this doctrine are considerable. In the first place, there can be no such thing as sin in any absolute sense. What one person calls sin, another may call virtue, and though they may dislike each other on account of this difference, neither can convict the other of intellectual error. Punishment cannot be justified on the ground that the criminal is wicked, but only on the ground that he has behaved in a way which others wish to discourage. Hell, as a place of punishment for sinners, becomes quite irrational. The more general consequences which are feared, such as the decay of all sense of moral obligation, are to be logically deduced. Moral obligation, if it is to influence conduct, must consist not merely of a belief, but of a desire. Such desires can, no doubt, be encouraged by example, education, and knowledge. But they can hardly be created by the mere abstract belief that they are good, nor discouraged by an analysis of what is meant by the word good. When we contemplate the human species, we may desire that it should be happy, or healthy, or intelligent, or warlike, and so on. Any one of these desires, if it is strong, will produce its own morality. But if we have no such general desires, our conduct, whatever our ethic may be, will only serve social purposes in so far as self-interest and the interests of the society are in harmony. It is the business of wise institutions to create such harmony as far as possible. And for the rest, whatever may be our theoretical definition of value, we must depend upon the existence of impersonal desires. Our desires are, in fact, more general and less purely selfish than many moralists imagine. If it were not so, no theory of ethics would make moral improvement possible. It is, in fact, not by ethical theory, but by the cultivation of large and generous desires through intelligence, happiness, and freedom from fear, that people can be brought to act more than they do at present in a manner that is consistent with the general happiness of humankind. Whatever our definition of the good, and whether we believe it to be subjective or objective, those who do not desire the happiness of humanity will not endeavour to further it, while those who do desire it will do what they can to bring it about. The scientific temper of mind is cautious, tentative, and piecemeal. It does not imagine that it knows the whole truth, or that even its best knowledge is wholly true. It knows that every doctrine needs emendation sooner or later, and that the necessary emendation requires freedom of investigation and freedom of discussion. But out of theoretical science, the scientific technique has developed, and the scientific technique has none of the tentativeness of a theory. Physics has been revolutionized during the present century by relativity and the quantum theory. But all inventions based upon the old physics are still found satisfactory. The practical experts who employ scientific technique, and still more the governments and large firms which employ the practical experts, acquire a quite different temper from that of the scientists, a temper full of a sense of limitless power, of arrogant certainty, and of pleasure in manipulation. This is the very reverse of the scientific temper, but it cannot be denied that science has helped to promote it. The direct effects of scientific technique have been by no means wholly beneficial. On the one hand, they have increased the destructiveness of weapons of war. On the other hand, by increasing the productivity of labour, they have made the old economic system, which depended upon scarcity, very difficult to work with. And by the violent impact of new ideas, they have thrown ancient civilizations off their balance. The warfare between science and theology, in spite of an occasional skirmish on the outposts, is nearly ended. And I think most religious people would admit that their religion is the better for it. Christianity has been purified of inessentials inherited from a barbarous age, and nearly cured of the desire to persecute. But while the older religions have thus become purified, and in many ways beneficial, new religions have arisen, with all the persecuting zeal, and with as great a readiness to oppose science, as characterized by the Inquisition. The persecution of intellectuals by totalitarian regimes has surpassed, in severity, anything perpetrated by the churches during the last 250 years. It may be urged that persecution in our day, unlike the past, is political and economic rather than theological. But such a plea would be unhistorical. Economic and political motives have always been a part cause of persecution, perhaps even the main cause. In any case, the argument against the persecution of opinion does not depend upon what the excuse for persecution may be. The argument is that we none of us know all truth, that the discovery of new truth is promoted by free discussion and rendered very difficult by suppression, and that in the long run human welfare is increased by the discovery of truth and hindered by action based on error. New truth is often inconvenient to some vested interest, but it is in the interest of the community at large that new truth should be freely promulgated. Those to whom intellectual freedom is personally important may be a minority in the community, but among them are the people of most importance to the future. New truth is often uncomfortable, especially to the holders of power. Nevertheless, amid the long record of cruelty and bigotry, it is the most important achievement of our intelligent but wayward species.